Good afternoon. This is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. It is February 4th, and we have a very big agenda today. Welcome, Senator Lori. You're going to kick us off with Senate File 207, a bill related to child out-of-home placement costs, county reimbursement authorization. So that's complicated language that you're going to make absolutely clear to us, I'm sure.
I will do my best, Madam Chair. Thank you. Madam Chair and members, I do have Senate File 207 before you today. Before we get started, I have a little bit of cleanup language. This is our first hearing. I'd like to move the A3. Looks like we probably don't have a quorum.
We don't have a quorum yet.
We can adopt that. We'll have the A3 passed out maybe, and maybe staff can help me remember to move this as soon as we have a quorum. It's an author's amendment that just cleans up the language. It was a little bit awkward in its construction to include basically out-of-home placement includes the foster.
Can you pull your microphone forward, Senator Lori? We're having a hard time hearing you. I'm not even sure if I can be heard here.
I can hear you. I got my hearing aids and so it helps. But I will try to speak directly into the microphone. And so we'll move the A3 as soon as we have a quorum. Let me know when that comes. So this is in regards to funding that would go to the counties to support Indian Child Welfare Act cases of child protection. And so a little background, you know, on the Indian Child Welfare Act, just a very brief one. You know, when we've had a lot of discussion, and Madam Chair, you've been really involved in the Child Protection Task Force and their work, and a component of the work that counties do involves children that are tribal children, and the Indian Child Welfare Act from the federal level interacts with that, such that there's a requirement typically early on in the process for tribal courts to intervene in child protection cases involving Indian children, and they can take over the management of the case to make sure that it's a culturally appropriate treatment, try to keep that cultural component and really better serve children and have much better outcomes for children in need of protection. But the county's left with the full tab for funding those for the pieces that don't come. There is some federal reimbursement that flows to the counties to support the ICWA cases, but that part that doesn't come from the feds, the counties are turning the oversight of the cases over to the tribal courts and left with the bill. And it is an issue that's been discussed a bit. This is actually a law that is a proposal that's formulated on a law that used to be in place to pick up a lot of the ICWA costs that fall to our county partners. So I'll kind of leave the background of it at that, and I'll just describe the mechanics of the bill. One, two, three, four, five. We're getting close to a quorum.
Very close.
Then I will ask a couple of testifiers to come forward and present their views on how this would operate. So Senate File 207, the basic premise that it was modify the local government aid chapter of law paid through aids and credits. Subdivision 1 defines the term of out-of-home placement for purposes of this law. And that was the subject of the A3 amendment. It cleans up that definition of out-of-home placement. Subdivision 2 provides the mechanism for counties to report out-of-home placement data to the Commissioner of Human Services in order to determine out-of-home placement expenditures for children placed under the Indian Child Welfare Act. And the Commissioner of Human Services is required to certify to the Commissioner of Revenue and our legislative committees responsible for local government aids and out-of-home placement funding if the data reported by the counties accurately reflects expenditures. Once that's been accomplished, Subdivision 3 requires the Commissioner of Revenue to reimburse each county for their costs of the non-federal share of the out-of-home placement for children under ICWA, provided the Commissioner of Human Services certifies the data accurately reflects the expenditures as reported. Subdivision 4 is simply boilerplate governmental aid appropriation language, and the section would be effective beginning with aids payable in 2017. With that, I would ask for Pine County Commissioner Steve Hallen to come forward and give a little bit of the county perspective. After that, I think we have one more testifier from the Association of Counties to come and describe a little bit. I'd be happy to stand for questions, too, as at any time you felt appropriate.
Thank you, Senator Laurie. We do have a quorum, so I'm going to renew your motion, Senator Laurie, to pass the A3 amendment. It's an author's amendment. This is the first hearing. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Halen, to the committee. Would you introduce yourself and where you're from and then begin your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of this committee. I'm Stephen Holland. I'm the board chair of the Pine County Board of Commissioners. I live in Pine City. Pine County is a geographically very large county. It stretches about 60 miles of freeway between here and Duluth. We do have a significant native population, and so consequently our out-of-home placements have a portion of those children are covered under the Child Welfare Act, Indian Child Welfare Act. Give you a perspective on what that costs is roughly last year about $1 million of county levy was spent on out-of-home placements. This is in a county that only generates about $14 million total in levy. So we spent $1 million on out-of-home placement costs. Out of that million, about $350,000 were on children that fall under the Indian Child Welfare Act. So 35% of our out-of-home placement costs are with natives. About 80% of all of those cases are ordered by tribal courts. A child that is deemed to be removed from the home can either be from district court or from tribal court, and the tribal court has a portion of that child's welfare, no matter who orders that. The problem we have is we have to pay 100% of that bill, and we would like some relief from that, and this bill would offer that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Did you have another testifier?
Madam Chair, I it was my understanding we do have one more. Yes.
Hello, Ms. Westland. Would you introduce yourself to the committee and who you're representing?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Rochelle Westland, and I'm the Health and Human Services Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties, or AMC. Thank you for your time today. As you know, AMC represents commissioners in all 87 counties throughout Minnesota, and counties play an integral role in the delivery services of state-mandated human services programs. And one of our greatest areas of responsibility is that of child protection. AMC appreciates Senator Laurie's leadership in supporting counties in this important work with Senate File 207. Out-of-home placements are of great financial cost to counties. Counties such as Beltrami, for example, have a per capita spending of $831 for children's services. As you can imagine, this places a high demand on local property taxes. Unfortunately, many Native American children that are in our child protection system end up in out-of-home placement. When placing a Native American child, counties often must look beyond their borders to find placement that's culturally appropriate. And while counties are supportive of this principle, it does often come at an additional cost. This bill provides counties with the financial backing to help shift local discussion from how to finance this out-of-home placement to further collaboration between counties and tribes as we work together to seek culturally appropriate placements where children can receive traditional healing and support services that give Native American families the best chances at success. As all of you know, there's been a great deal of scrutiny placed upon the child protection system, and as counties, along with the Task Force on Child Protection, seek to determine how best to provide these services for families in need, I would remind you as legislators that bills such as this that help secure funding for the counties in areas of child protection go a long way to providing and improving services statewide for counties large and small. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I will add, it has been mentioned a couple of times, the important work of the Child Protection Task Force that you and Senator Rosen both serve on. And I would be remiss if I didn't say we are anticipating your March further report and final recommendations, and do recognize that to date, the proposals that have been brought forward have not really proposed to make the state that financial partner to the counties to help fund their important work in child protection. And this is one proposal of probably multiple that we will see before we're done here. And we will certainly be respectful of and take a look at the final report that comes out in, I believe, March for the child protection, and put that in the mix and try to find the best way to make the state the most productive partner to help counties with their incredibly important and state-mandated role in performing their child protection services for those children in dire need of supports and protection.
Thank you, Senator Lori. I'm absolutely certain there will be conversations eventually about how to pay for the reforms that right now, 50% of those costs are borne by counties, and their source of revenue is property tax. So there's no question that we will be struggling with how to achieve and how to best pay for these outcomes. So with that, review of the bill, are there any questions from committee members? Seeing none, Senator Lori, would you like to move passage of your bill and referral to taxes?
Senator Sharon, I would move Senate File 207 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you members. For your presence here today. Good
Sharon,
afternoon.
You are here to present Senate File 410 and also Senate File 407. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I have to take my glasses off because I can't read with them, and I refuse to get bifocal, so, which is part of the aging
process, I guess.
We should have some
conversations. Yeah, I'm going to have some conversations about this. Thank you. I'm here to present two bills to you today. One is the Senate File 410, which I'd like to present to you first, and then Senate File 407, I think is the number. The amendment is to Senate File 410, correct? So if we can begin, with your permission, Madam Chair, with Senate File 410, I'd like to offer an amendment to the bill as an author's amendment.
Yes.
It is the A1 amendment.
Senator Sharon moves to amend Senate File 410 with the A1 amendment, and that was in our packet at our places.
Yes, this amendment, Madam Chair, indicates that the grant program will continue into the future. We'd fail to articulate that clearly in the first part of the bill. And then I have another oral amendment, after you've completed that amendment.
Okay. And Senator Scher moves to amend Senate File 410 with the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
And then I noticed as I was reading through the bill that under Subdivision 2, Paragraph A, there's language related to the awards of these grants to nonprofit organizations. And I just thought that it might be helpful if we added language that included, I hope I use the correct terminology, is it county public health boards or public health boards? Boards of health.
Can you state which line you're wishing to add? Oh,
I would ask Ms. Kavanaugh to offer the language.
Ms. Kavanaugh?
Madam Chair and members, on page 1, line 15, after organizations, insert, and county public health boards.
Are there any questions about the oral amendment? Okay. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, and thank you all for giving me some of your time and interest on these two Senate files today, 410 and 407. Both of these bills are designed to encourage the use of effective methods in communities to engage families in important early conversations about the later stages of life. As you know, the governor's budget supports another proposal that focuses on planning for life's transitions later in life called Owning Your Future. But this proposal focuses on encouraging early financial conversations and planning. These earlier conversations are important, especially about subjects we like to avoid or put off. And as a consequence, we never quite have that conversation or create the communications that are necessary to describe the roadmap we want to the unstated goal of living life in all of its phases as we would choose, with as much control of that experience of living that we can achieve. The life's transitions might be thought about like a sporting event with quarters and half times. Conversations about the first quarter go on in this legislature all the time. They are about birth and infancy and youth and adolescence. And then in the second quarter, we spend a lot of time talking about emancipation, military service, work skill preparation, and marriage. And governments engage in these conversations because we share with the public the interest in having these transitions be as successful as possible. We need to also engage in these early conversations, continual and constant conversations, about all of the developmental stages so that we can create a positive outcome as individuals move through later life transitions. Early conversations about later life transitions often are left by the wayside, and as a result, they become emergency decisions, making rather than the careful and thoughtful conversations that we should have with families or with our spiritual advisors, attorneys, as well as our healthcare providers. This conversation needs to be as early and as constant as our conversations about growth and development during early stages in life. This bill joins the governor's proposal, Own Your Own Future, by providing grants. This is 410, the grants bill. It's called Let's Talk About It Now. Let's Talk Now. And it's grants that are designed using the SHIP model. They are grants to communities to develop and plan a plan for how those communities will engage families or community members or organizations in this kind of conversation. It's not only a conversation about finances, but about the legal authority that someone wants to have in their life should they not be able to have the conversation themselves. It's about their spiritual needs. It's about their caregiver preferences. It's about where they want to live. It's about the desires they have about their care when life has taken away their ability to communicate those preferences to their family or physician. As I said, these grants are really designed to be implemented in the same way that the SHIP grant is. And if you remember, those are community-based, defined and designed grant proposals that are competitive grants implemented through the Department of Health. The Commissioner of Health, as in SHIP grants, is designated and charged with awarding these grants to nonprofits and now to also health boards. And these grants are for a targeted initiative that encourages this kind of conversation and make life planning resources available to them. The grantees have to report to the commissioner about their programs. The bill also directs the Commissioner of Health to award another grant. In the 410, there is a second award, which is to a statewide advanced care planning group for technical assistance. Honoring Choices, we'll hear from them today, has all sorts of resources and expertise and training capacity to help communities engage in the activities in an effective way, in a way that is based on already demonstrated positive outcomes. So this percentage that will be defined in the future for technical assistance will be directed to Honoring Choices to give the technical support to communities to carry out these grants. So I think I'll stop there and pick up the second bill and describe it at a later time. But in relationship to the first bill, I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Kuchar. I would have Dr. Kuchar introduce himself to the committee and begin his testimony.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Greg Kuchar. I'm a family practice physician in the Mayo Clinic Health System in southwest Minnesota. And I'm grateful for this opportunity to provide my perspectives on these two bills. I believe we will decrease the suffering of patients and their families inflicted with severe and or progressive conditions by helping them have the conversations with the important people in their lives in order to make decisions based on their personal goals and concerns. For some, these conversations occur without much outside prompting. For others, these conversations don't occur because there's not enough time or the right circumstances. In that case, the result is more suffering and often with long-standing consequences for the patient, their families, and their communities. I have witnessed many miracles and advancements in how we take care of patients. And at the same time, I know there's much to do to make healthcare more accessible, decrease the burdens that disease bring, and partner to improve the health in our communities. This initiative, both of these bills, 407 and 410, to encourage better conversations is a crucial step in the broader context of improving healthcare. When patients and their families have the time and are in the right circumstances to have these conversations, it inspires and provides the comfort that decisions were made with good information and are exactly in line with what the patient wants. Oftentimes, this does not happen. Healthcare and treatment options have become more complex, and the need for these conversations has increased. There's often a plethora of choices and conflicting advice on the best options, and often there really is no best choice. And given this complexity, it's not surprising that families often express regrets about how decisions were made. For example, many times family members have told me that they had no idea their loved one was near death, and how they wish they had said and done things that matter most to them. The best decisions comes when a patient and family talks about and knows their values. Healthcare providers cannot and should not do this by ourselves. We have been improving. We have been training and developing processes and systems to encourage these conversations. However, oftentimes these conversations occur best in settings away from traditional healthcare. They can occur at work or with a trusted advisor, such as a family's legal advisor or insurance professional. They occur in faith-based organizations and schools. Just in South Central Minnesota, we have many examples where community members like Ben Lewins in Springfield have worked to bring these ideas, tools, and skills to their community. With a relatively minor investment, this legislation will expand already proven efforts to reach many more people, especially those in populations that suffer from healthcare disparity and lack of access. Finally, I will emphasize that this is not about filling out an advanced directive as an end in itself. The advanced directive is more of a tangible sign that patients and their families have had the conversation and understand each other. By providing resources, we can decrease the suffering that occurs for patients and their families dealing with severe and progressive illnesses and conditions. And these are individuals, one at a time, and the bill will impact them. So again, thank you for your kind attention, and I look forward to any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kuchar. Would you like to have your other witness testify at this point?
I'm going to save my other witness for the next bill.
What I would
prefer to do, with your permission, Madam Chair, is simply articulate the essence of the bill, 410, and then entertain any questions.
Senator Sharon, just a question. There's another witness listed, Stephanie Girdas. Did you wish to have her testify at this time?
Yes, I'm sorry. Please forgive me, Ms. Girdas. She would like to testify to this bill.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Sharon, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Stephanie Girdas. I'm a licensed social worker with Mayo Clinic Health System in Fairmont. I have worked in the field of medical social work, most specifically long-term care in greater Minnesota, for the past 16 years. I have the honor on a daily basis of working side-by-side with patients and families that find themselves needing to make difficult decisions. And all too often what we find is the conversation has never happened about what we would do if this situation presents. So I find myself at patients' bedsides and in emergency room waiting rooms, sitting beside families as they're struggling through trying to decide what they should do. And they end up having to make those complex decisions that are presented to them, and then later find themselves maybe regretting those situations and having to live with that burden for the rest of their lives. But there are scenarios, too, where I find that people have had those conversations and what that can be like. And when those difficult situations present themselves, there's still emotion. There's still sadness as that journey ends, because that's human nature. But families can make those decisions with confidence, knowing that they're advocating on behalf of the ones that are near and dear to them. And what better gift can we give to the people we love than to eliminate the burden and the stress in that already difficult time? Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, did you?
Yes, thank you. The bill is 410 is in front of you, and as amended, will provide an ongoing grant through the Department of Health for communities to design projects that will assist in these community conversations. In section one, Senator Marty, I wanted you to notice that we have named the bill Let's Talk Now Act, and I'm hoping it can slip by you. And section two creates the Advanced Care Planning Grant Program itself. Subdivision 1 defines advanced care planning. Then in Subdivision 2, it begins to describe that the Commissioner of Health will be required to award grants to nonprofit or boards of health organizations to develop and implement these comprehensive initiatives that are targeted to a designated community to encourage advanced care planning discussions among individuals and their families, caregivers, and healthcare providers. Then paragraph B under subdivision 2 states the purposes of the grant. When the grantees fill out the forms that will be designated to them by the Department of Health, they will have to speak to how their initiative meets these objectives to increase social awareness of the need for advanced care planning, to encourage and assist individuals and families to begin to have and continue to have advanced care planning discussions based on informed choices, needs, and values. And then finally, promoting the availability and increased awareness of resources available to them in this process. Paragraph C requires the initiatives to be based on best practices, public health research principles, and on community input will be important to be documented, the needs and values of the object of the grant, and to address health disparities and cultural differences that may exist in the communities to be served. Paragraph D requires the application dates, submission dates, and what must be specified in the proposed initiative, its outcomes, and its evaluation. Paragraph E requires the commissioner to award the grants by a given date. Paragraph F requires each grant recipient to report to the commissioner on the progress of the initiative. Subdivision 3 requires the commissioner to award a grant to a statewide advanced care planning resource organization. This is the section of the bill that talks about a certain percentage will go to an organization honoring choices to provide the technical support and the resources to the communities to carry out the grants initiatives. And Subdivision 4 requires the commissioner to submit a report to the legislature. And then we added Subdivision 5 because we wanted to be clear that nothing in the bill or in this section should be construed to condone or authorize or approve mercy killing or euthanasia or assisted suicide. That is not the focus of this bill, and it appropriates money to the Commissioner of Health for this purpose. And that's the summary of the contents of the bill, and I would hope that you would be supportive of advancing this bill to finance. I think it goes to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Senator Rosen?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sharon, perhaps more of a comment than a question, that this has been modeled after the SHIP program. And the SHIP program in my Senate district has been very successful because it has reached across county lines, brought a lot of different entities together that are communicating that they've never communicated before. They've got a single focus, of course, what this bill does too. But I'm hoping that this bill, this initiative, will also do that, reach across many different barriers and collaborate with many entities to make sure that it's just not in a one designated area, that it goes out and has an effect for a long way out.
Senator Sharon?
Yes, I absolutely agree. The grant allows for a definition of community to be broad, and it might be a whole system, health system. But it can also be defined as within the geographic boundaries of a school district, for example. We leave that to the grantees who want to define that. But when they come to the Department of Health and they go through the process of screening, they use those same principles that we use with SHIP, which is to take a look to see of the choices what meet the criteria the best, meet the largest group of people, and integrate especially the concerns we have about groups that typically are not reached through these programs. So I appreciate your comment, and I share the expectation. I failed to mention, Madam Chair, that the members of the committee have a couple of letters of support. One is from the Minnesota Medical Association, the other is from the Cancer Action Network. And we also know, although you do not have letters, that this is, we also have communications of support from AARP and from Leading Age Minnesota. And I'm certain we'll be adding to this list.
Thank you. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sharon, I think you might have answered this as you were answering Senator Rosen, but I'm looking at Subdivision 2 on page 1. Let's see, line 15 at the very end, targeted to a designated community. I just want to be clear, we're not trying to target a designated community. The commissioner can choose to target a designated community. I feel like that's limiting language, and I just want to be clear that I understand what it means.
Senator Sharon?
I'm not exactly clear. Were you asking whether the commissioner can designate the community, or the grantee must define the community that they will be serving?
Okay, and then the commissioner. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I interrupted.
Senator Benson?
But so then the commissioner could decide if that's a valid designation and award the grant based on that. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to clarify.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Senator Sharon, for bringing this conversation out again. It needs to happen. And as we do look at that, I have a statement and a question. I get nervous when we start having these conversations and we hear words like decreasing burdens, because it reminds me of years ago in a place called Hadamar. And I don't want us to go down that line, but what I do want to hope we do, looking at values, if somebody's on an elderly waivered service or somebody's a ward of the state, how in the contextual degree are they going to be a part of that personal choice or what their patients wants when somebody else is there? And in there is that little fine gray area that I'm always concerned about, is who's advocating on behalf of that individualized needs and not the need of the team who says that they think this is what's right for them. So I like what you put in Section 5, but I'd like to see something stronger that really helps understand the unique and individualized needs and how we're going to address the people that are like on elderly waivered services or wards of the state.
Senator Sharon?
Well, I think that the group whose needs you are referring to are exactly the group that we're trying to, among the people that we're trying to engage in much earlier conversations that would define clearly the choices that person wants to make for how they will live their life most fully to its very last day. And that's what this is about, to engage that conversation much earlier in the process, whether they're on an elderly waiver or if they're not on an elderly waiver. There's nothing in here that a community might say, we want to focus specifically on that group of people as a part of their local initiative. Or they might choose another, to train healthcare providers in the strategies and techniques that Honoring Choices has developed that they know are effective in order to assist with these conversations. So I don't want to narrow down what the communities in their community conversations about seeking this grant choose at this time to do with those resources.
Senator,
did you want to speak to this, Dr. Kuchar? I saw you.
Do you
have a follow-up question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Senator Sharon. Exactly. I misrepresented myself. I don't want to narrow it down, but I want us to be very cautious and very careful about how we're planning out this process. If it's based on the SHIP model, great. But still, if we don't have some protections in place, and I do, that's why I liked Section 5 in there, but I'm still a little concerned that sometimes within our world of doing well, an IDT team or a team that is representing and speaking or so-called speaking on behalf of an individual that they think is best for them, I have sometimes concerns about making sure we honor that individual regardless of where they're at. And that there lies in that little piece that I have some caution on. If we start to devolve it out and we're not there making sure that there's some advocacy protecting individual rights, that this could slide down into something that I don't like. And so I'm really having a hard time with that. And I just want to get your assurance on that, and I know I can support that.
And I think you're
Senator
talking
Sharon.
About the very thing. I'm going to have Dr. Kuchar talk about this because he mentioned it during the press conference. It's exactly what we're trying to have happen less often, which is earlier conversations, clear communications, not just one time, but periodically updating and reviewing what the wishes of that person are. There is a point sometimes in some people's lives where they can no longer communicate. So by that time, we are not wanting the healthcare system to try to make those decisions. We want that person to have been engaged in conversations long before then about what they want, communicated that to who will be making those decisions for them at the end of life, should that be the situation that occurs. So that's exactly what this is about and what we're trying to achieve. And Dr. Kuchar spoke about this very eloquently earlier at a press conference, and I'd ask you to talk about that again, which, the focusing on making certain that these conversations occur that allow that the choice of the individual is what we're paying attention to, and not allowing other things to sort of take over the process.
Dr. Kuchar, go ahead.
Thank you. I'll do my best. It's a complex question, and I'm really glad you're asking it, because oftentimes it gets confusing. I will go back to my original statement, which is healthcare has become incredibly complex, and there's a lot of confusion that goes on. And since there is confusion, when we get to these situations where decisions have to be made, a lot of times people are trying to interpret what they thought the patient, if the patient is not very able to speak to themselves, trying to guess what they might have said. Oftentimes you also have other people involved, maybe a family member who is at a different place. And a lot of times patients' wishes, quite honestly, are not followed because a family member isn't quite ready to accept them, whatever direction it's going. Sometimes it's different directions. So I think this bill, the way I see it, is basically to encourage initiatives we already have in place, which is reaching out into our communities and teaching people how to have those conversations amongst themselves so it's very clear what the wishes of that patient might be. And we just need a little push to help that. This isn't about a bill about, if I'm understanding your question, it's not a bill around pushing a certain decision about whether to be more aggressive or less aggressive. It's really about making sure people can be talking about it ahead of time so there isn't confusion.
Need to move on to Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, to Senator Huffman, I think, Senator Huffman, you're expressing the legitimate concern about who makes decisions for somebody when they're not able to make them themselves. This is trying to help people make them for themselves before they get into that position. This is not about making choices for somebody. This is helping them discuss what choices they want. And when Senator Sharon was talking about life being like a football game in first quarter, so there's also in football sudden death, and that's why I think it's important to have people deciding early on in discussions with kids and everyone. I mean, our kids are adult kids, and I want them to be involved in knowing what my wife and I want so that they can help reflect that as well. And I think that's the whole point, is you express a very legitimate concern. Who makes the choice when the person's not able to? This is saying let's get there before they get to that point so that person's choices can be made.
Senator Huffman, briefly, please.
Yeah, I'll be brief. Thank you, Madam Chair. My point is, honorable intentions aside, I like what you're saying, there still has to be some level of accountability because there was honorable intentions in what they wanted to do with Hadamar, and there were 10,000 children that were killed in that honorable intention. So I'm not equating this, but I'm just saying I want to make sure that we're making sure that there's a level of accountability here and advocacy and protection, and that's all. So I could probably support that, knowing that is in there. So,
okay. Thank you. Senator Sharon?
I'd like to move Senate File 410, recommend it pass, and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Sharon moves to
as amended.
Recommend it to pass Senate File 410 as amended. Be recommended to pass and be referred to finance. All those in favor? I'm sorry.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
Senator Sharon, I did notice that in there earlier, and I was also a co-author of Senator Peterson's bill.
I thought I could get
And I think it's good to call this the Let's Talk Now Act bill. I don't know that we need to put that in statute. And so I would encourage you to think we should take this out. I won't offer the motion. I'll encourage you to either here or in Senator Laurie's committee, but we don't need to put in statute what you want to call it, because that's for the point of getting it passed so people can know why we're doing this, because it's very important. I appreciate you doing the bills. I won't make the motion now, but I'll encourage you to in Senator Laurie's.
Thank you, Senator Marty. And we have a motion before us. Is there any other discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
It doesn't.
Motion passes.
Thank you very much. We now will move to a smaller bill, Senate File 407. This is a bill that quite simply makes an appropriation from the general fund to the Commissioner of Health to award a grant to a statewide advanced care planning resource organization that has this very special experience and expertise in convening and coordinating community-based strategies to encourage individuals and families and caregivers, healthcare providers, to begin these conversations. That's the sum total of the bill. I don't have any amendments to this bill, so
would you like
Chair,
your
may
testifier
I have to my testifier? I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Ken Kephart. I want to introduce him because you should hear his credentials. Dr. Greg Kucher has many as well, but he asked me not to give them today, so I let him introduce himself.
Do the same thing.
Yeah. No, you don't really?
Listen to this. Family medicine physician, you know, that's just start the baseline. Medical director of geriatric services at Fairview Health Services. President of the Twin Cities Medical Society and the medical director of Honoring Choices Minnesota, which is an initiative of the Medical Society, and it is in relationship to Honoring Choices that he is here to speak to you today.
Thank you, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, this is Ken Kephart, and first I want to thank Senator Sharon and the committee for hearing my testimony, and also to Senator Franson, St. Jim, Marty, and Rosen for agreeing to help support the bill. As a physician, I appreciate your leadership on this issue. Every day I see sick patients and families struggling with decisions they are being asked to make in the middle of a crisis, as has been mentioned, without the benefit of any meaningful discussion or direction. So the families are pretty much lost in what to do. And frequently I hear the situation described as they feel like they're in front of a runaway train that starts down this road of increasing complexity and decision-making that they're not understanding in moments of crisis. Studies clearly show that the lack of advanced care planning conversations leads to patients being treated in a way they didn't prefer, dying in a place they didn't want to be in, and their families suffering from increased grief, guilt, and depression after their death. And there's been many studies showing this. And I think clearly we can do better. So what may seem to be a simple discussion about who do you want to make a decision if you're too ill to make it, that just that very decision can be more complex than it seems. And that's why we found over our 6 years of working that it does help to have somebody trained in the nuances of that discussion. I'll give you an example. Most people choose their next of kin as their person they want to make decisions for them, which seems natural, and many times that's appropriate. But think about a married couple who've been married 60 years, 50 years. And I personally have seen a wife's face go white when her husband's talking about his wishes at the end of life, knowing that she's the one that's supposed to carry out those wishes. And so I would ask her, can you do this? Can you do what your husband wants? Can you take him out of the hospital and plug him and bring him home so he can die in his home? And she said, well, I know that's what he wants, but I could never make that decision. I just can't. So it's important to know that. And so then we brought in adult children, and we found an adult child who's willing to make that decision. The wife's fine with that. She just didn't want to be the one making that decision. And we, I think, solved a potential problem with that conversation. That's what we're talking about, having conversations ahead of time. So we find out who's the appropriate person to help make a decision and to find out what the patient values as to how they want to be cared for at the end of life. I'll just take a brief aside on Senator Hoffman's concern. I actually run with Fairview a program that deals with the dual eligible MCHO population and their elderly waiver patients. And so I know that they do have assigned care managers who are either nurses or social workers, professionals, that are assigned to help manage their care along with the clinicians. And they take it very seriously, their job of helping advocate for the patient. And part of what we found out is that many people are comfortable having discussions inside a clinic, many people aren't. especially some of our population we deal with in Twin Cities that are in the elderly waiver program are new to our country, different cultures, and they don't understand or trust decisions that are, or discussions that are happening inside a hospital. They don't really know. It's a new experience for them, and they're not sure why we're asking those questions about how they want to be cared for if something terrible happens. Those conversations need to be taken outside of the healthcare system and done in communities, in their communities, where with people they can trust. And so our care managers, social workers, help facilitate that. They can help have the discussions. They can find where the individual goes to their mosque or whatever, and find a way to have that discussion in a safe place and bring it forward. So that's, I think there will be safeguards for that particular population that you talked about. I'm getting back on message, sorry. But I was just itching to say something, because that's, I deal with that every day. I think ultimately our programs, I'm working for 6 years in a variety of different communities, started in Twin Cities, but now we have efforts underway in St. Cloud, Bemidji, Springfield, Fergus Falls, Cloquet, among others. I think we have a standardized training program for facilitators so they can stay on message, help them understand the nuances of the decision-making and some of the choices that are being asked. We also, importantly for health systems and clinics, have a validated quality improvement process so they can actually measure their results, how they're doing, in a standardized way so they can continue to improve that process. So I think that's other value we can add as a technical component to these community efforts. So I'll just close by just saying that with a few facts. 25% of patients see 10 or more physicians in their last 6 months of life. That's how complex dying has become. So you can imagine the confusion and different messages that can happen during there. Families don't know a majority of time what their loved one would want, even though the patient thinks they do. There's been many studies. Patients say, oh, yeah, my wife knows what I want done. You ask the wife, she doesn't know. She doesn't feel comfortable making those decisions. That's been really well documented. And then that results in people dying where they don't want to die. 7 in 10 say they would prefer to die at home, and only 15% actually do. Nearly 70% die in a nursing home, hospital, or long-term care assisted living facility. And we don't use hospice early enough for people who are clearly going to be dying in the next 6 months and would like to die at home, and that's one of the ways that can happen. So I think we can do better. Some of the systems we are working with have doubled the rate of advanced care planning at the time of death, and we have a huge opportunity here in Minnesota to expand the advanced care planning movement into the rest of Minnesota and to diverse communities and faith-based organizations. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, did you have any other comments?
No, that completes our presentation on Senate file 407. Just to be clear, it's to fund these this information, this training, extending out throughout the state, already defined practices that have shown to have positive outcomes, ability to measure outcomes, comes with the technical assistance throughout the state with the support of this bill.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Sharon, and in no way to denigrate the work of Honoring Choices. I get a little concerned when we're really specific about directing money. Do you think this language is written broadly enough that if there's another organization who'd like to compete, that they could step forward and have a chance at these training grants?
Yes, the Honoring Choices is not named in the legislation. It just happens to be the only organization, at least that I know of, that has the 6 years of experience and the materials and the resources and the research supporting how they help train facilitators.
Okay, and
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, then I'll just place it out there. If there are any other organizations that think they can do this, we should hear what they're offering to and make sure that we're reaching as far and wide as we can, looking for best practices. And I wish you well with your organization. We just want to make sure that we're not carving people out is my only concern. Thank you, Senator Sharon.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Hearing no other questions.
Thank you. I'd like to move Senate File number 407 be passed and move to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you. Senator Sharon has moved that Senate File 407 be recommended to pass and referred to Finance. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion
Thank
passes.
You very much.
Thank you.
Yikes.
That's why he disappeared.
There were people who said it was a waste of time.
True response is why don't we
but I don't know.
Make sure that we cover these conversations.
I suppose.
Have you done that?
When I was showing you.
Okay, how are we doing for time?
That's good. Yeah, you retired early because of that.
I didn't really market it that way.
I got done the whole
You do need some of that.
Good afternoon, Senator Nelson. Thank you for coming to our committee to present Senate File 247, which is a bill on Alzheimer's and other dementia research grants and programs, establishes a research advisory council, and appropriates money. Please introduce yourself as one of the members of this committee and begin your testimony. And would you, as you proceed, introduce your testifiers as well. Is there any action you need the committee to take at this time?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. And for the record, I am Senator Carla Nelson from your committee here. Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to offer the A1 amendment to get the Senate file in 247 in the shape that the author wishes.
Senator Nelson offers the A1 amendment. Is this a delete all amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is a delete all amendment. Actually, it doesn't change much at all from the original bill, but it's just organized in a little bit cleaner fashion.
Okay, thank you. So Senator Nelson offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Excuse me, Senator Lurie.
Just real quick, Senator Nelson, you had indicated you wished to me that you wished to make an oral amendment to the A1.
Yes.
You're going to do that after? Or?
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, I do have an oral amendment, which I will be glad to either add to the A1 now or after it's passed, I will add
Your
the
preference.
Oral amendment. Let's do it right this way.
All
Madam
right,
Chair,
go ahead.
Senator Lurie. So you have the delete all A1 amendment in front of you, and to that amendment, I would like to orally insert the words on line 1.4 after the Commissioner of Health. Please insert, in consultation with the Commissioner of Higher Education.
Senator Lurie.
We don't have a Commissioner of Higher Education. I guess we have a Director of the Office of Higher
yes.
Education, something like that.
Yes.
Maybe
okay.
staff could help.
Director of
Office of
HESO, I think.
POGI.
Yeah, it's Senator Hogemiller in this case.
So it would be.
Exactly. Maybe staff can help me get the exact terminology so there's no question.
It is the term. Well, why don't we go ahead with the A1 amendment as it is, and then we can
we'll
work that out later so we can move forward with our time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So we're going to go back to the original A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you. Please proceed, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate supporting having you hear the Alzheimer's Research and Support Act today. And also I want to acknowledge the co-sponsors on this bill, Senator Sharon and Senator Rosen on this committee, and also Senators Pappas and Senator Cohen. And I appreciate the strong bipartisan support for this bill. The goal is to determine the causes, prevention, treatment, and cures for Alzheimer's disease and other dementias through the advancement of research, to provide and enhance care and support for all those affected, and to reduce the risk of dementia through the promotion of brain health. Now, I believe my testifiers today will speak to you about the incidence and the importance of research, and then I will follow up with a few final comments and also an actual walk through the bill so you actually know exactly what you have in front of you. It's pretty straightforward. But with that, Madam Chair, I would like to introduce Dr. Clifford Jack, Professor of Diagnostic Radiology and Alexander Family Professor of Alzheimer's Disease Research at the Mayo Clinic.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name
is Dr. Jack. Welcome.
Oh, thanks. I didn't hear. I can't talk.
It is. Thank you. Because you couldn't hear me, it reminds me to tell you all that this is acoustics in here are terrible, so you almost have to put your mouth on the microphone in order for us to hear you. So please, to the best of your ability, would you try to do that?
Sure. Better?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Okay, so my name is Clifford Jack. I'm a neuroradiologist at the Mayo Clinic and I'm a full-time clinician researcher on cognitive aging and dementia with a focus on brain imaging. And I'm here to speak about dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Dementia refers to clinical symptomatology characterized by difficulties in thinking and in one's ability to carry out daily functions. Alzheimer's disease is one form or cause of dementia, but it is by far the most common. It's progressive, meaning it's not reversible, and is the most common illness leading to nursing home placement. The greatest risk factor by far is old age. The incidence doubles every 5 years after the age of 60, such that about half of all people over age 85 have dementia. Currently, there are 100,000 individuals in Minnesota diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. At a national level, at present, over 5 million people are diagnosed with dementia, but with the aging demographics of our society, projected United States numbers by 2050 are estimated to range between 11 and 16 million people. By 2050, annual costs in the United States are estimated at $1 trillion per year, with a cumulative cost from today to 2050 of over $20 trillion. This is clearly not economically sustainable. But these are only the measurable costs because 70% of patients with dementia live at home and not in a care facility. In the United States in 2009, an estimated 11 million unpaid caregivers, mainly family members, provided 12.5 billion hours of care to patients with dementia. These costs are not captured in statistics on healthcare economics. But again, monetary costs are actually only part of the picture. The most significant costs are the very personal costs to the patient, the family, and to loved ones. As you know, at present, there is no cure and no form of prevention. Available treatments address symptoms only, and realistically, only do so modestly in some patients and for a limited period of time. There are no currently available treatments that alter the inexorable downward trajectory of the disease. With that background, it may come as a surprise that historically funding for dementia and Alzheimer's research has been very low in comparison to other major diseases. We've all heard nothing but negative news about the serial failures of every disease-modifying therapeutic trial in Alzheimer's disease to date. But most people working in this field actually see a quite hopeful future. In recent years, there's been a major shift in thinking about the disease. The driving intellectual force today centers on the idea that the greatest hope for a cure is through prevention. Accordingly, a great deal of research is now focused on the earliest possible identification of the disease process, research on improved methods of early detection, and research on finding disease-modifying interventions go hand in hand, because prevention can only occur if the disease is detected early and then treatment is instituted early. A key issue is identifying those factors that differentiate the earliest evidence of Alzheimer's disease from the subtle and benign decline in cognitive abilities that characterizes normal aging. In conclusion, I can't think of a more timely opportunity for Minnesota to expand its role in fighting dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Minnesota is particularly well-positioned to lead research in this area because of our world-class research programs in early detection and the basic science of disease mechanisms. The proposed legislation will augment the resources of an already active community of investigators and provide support for agencies charged with the provision of services. As someone who has dedicated his career to research in this area, it's uplifting to see that the state of Minnesota is rising to the challenge of combating what many consider to be the defining medical problem of the 21st century. Thank you again for the opportunity to address the committee.
Thank you, Dr. Jack. Senator Nelson?
Madam Chair, would you like to hold questions till the testifiers?
The
yes, till the end. I'd also like to introduce then Dr. Joseph Gogler, Assistant Professor for the Center on Aging at the University of Minnesota.
Thank you so much, Senator Nelson, Madam Chair, and members. I'm really thrilled to have the opportunity to provide testimony in support of Bill 247 today. As Senator Nelson mentioned, my name is Joe Gogler. I'm an associate professor in the Center on Aging and School of Nursing at the University of Minnesota. And my research interests specifically are in Alzheimer's disease and long-term care, and specifically how we can best support families who care for loved ones with Alzheimer's disease. And I want to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about how does Alzheimer's disease affect families in Minnesota, what are some of the things we're trying to do to better support those families in Minnesota, and how could a bill such as SF-247 actually help advance these efforts. Some of this reiterates what Dr. Jack had already reviewed, but specifically because aging is a risk factor and because of the aging of the Minnesota population, we can expect an increase of roughly 36% over the next 10 years of people with Alzheimer's disease. Estimates vary in terms of actual numbers, but I think the percentage is probably pretty accurate. So clearly this is not something that is going away. I titled this particular slide Alzheimer's disease as the chronic condition. As Dr. Jack had mentioned, it is the defining medical condition for us to grapple with in the 21st century. And as you can see, when one number one looks at just total health care costs for people with Alzheimer's disease over the age of 65, specifically Medicare beneficiaries compared to those without Alzheimer's, costs are three times as great. And when you actually look at who we would call, quote unquote, super utilizers of healthcare, usually older persons with multiple co-occurring chronic conditions, if that person happens to have Alzheimer's disease, their costs go up exponentially. So that really, to me, makes the case that Alzheimer's disease isn't just a chronic disease, it's probably the chronic disease that complicates effective treatment and management of all other types of chronic disease and chronic conditions among older persons. So in that regard, it is something that is no doubt worthy of our attention and is certainly worthy of our attention as Minnesotans. So I think as many of us are too painfully aware, Alzheimer's disease has ripple effects. It doesn't just affect the person with Alzheimer's disease. It doesn't just affect healthcare systems. It affects the family members who must care for these persons. And quite frankly, family members are the bulk of the long-term care system, both in Minnesota and the United States. Currently, at least as of 2013, there's 245,000 family caregivers. These caregivers provided 280 million hours of care in 2013. Now, health economists sometimes try to attach a dollar value to this family care, and what they do is they basically estimate the replacement cost. If these family caregivers just went away and home health care aide or some similar professional needed to be hired, what would the value of family caregiving be? Quite frankly, I think that's a conservative approach, but nonetheless, that's the approach taken. And that value in 2013 Minnesota was $3.5 billion. Now, to put some context to that, if you looked at the Fortune 500 companies of 2013 and the annual revenue of those companies, company number 500, which incidentally is a Minnesota company, Nash Finch Company, reported an annual revenue of $4.8 billion. So essentially, family caregiving is nearly a Fortune 500 industry in and of itself in Minnesota. Okay. Now, while this is highly valuable, if not priceless, in terms of what families do in Minnesota, the health care costs for family caregivers are high. Those, again, family caregivers of a person with Alzheimer's disease in Minnesota, their health care costs were $161 million greater than non-caregivers in Minnesota. And certainly the costs of Alzheimer's caregiving extend well beyond the financial. Providing care over multiple years can cause psychological distress, emotional burden, and can eventually spill over into other life domains of the family member. For example, work-life balance. We know that over half of all caregivers who provide help to a relative with dementia report some type of disruption in work because of care responsibilities, and 9% report leaving work entirely. So again, the ripple effect of Alzheimer's extends beyond the person to both the family, to healthcare systems, and quite frankly, to employers as well. What I wanted to do here real briefly was to kind of think about, number one, some of the work we've been doing at the University of Minnesota in supporting caring families, but more importantly, how could something like SF, this particular bill, really advance that work? I run a group of projects called Families and LTC, and really the basis and focus of these projects are how can we develop programs that best support family caregivers of persons with Alzheimer's disease. For example, one project, the NYU-CIAC, this was a comprehensive psychosocial support program for adult children who cared for parents with dementia. We've just started publishing the results of this project over the last couple years. We found that providing comprehensive psychosocial support to families actually allowed them to keep their relatives at home for 231 days longer than those who didn't receive the program. So taking this family-level kind of approach in helping to treat and manage Alzheimer's disease is quite effective and perhaps cost-effective as well. A lot of our work influences the community outreach and engagement we do, primarily this Caring for a Person with Memory Loss Conference, which is an annual conference we hold at the University of Minnesota. It includes 200 to 300 attendees. It's free. We live stream it and record it so anybody throughout the state or beyond can virtually attend. And has been a great success, and it's been something we've been doing since 2008. What would be great is if we could take a model like this, which is influenced by the research we do, and take it on the road in Minnesota. One of my goals with this conference is I don't want to just hold it physically at the University of Minnesota. I would love to hold it in all the different area agencies on aging throughout greater Minnesota. A bill such as SF 247 would definitely be able to support an initiative such as this. You know, providing this community education, community outreach, really related to brain health, brain fitness, et cetera. And that's just one possible example of how a bill such as this could really support our work. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention all the other great researchers at the University of Minnesota who are doing incredible work on both the biological mechanisms of Alzheimer's, pharmacological and non-pharmacological treatments and health services work. I've listed only a very few here, but these are all members of a group we call the Twin Cities Consortium of Alzheimer's Research, where all of us from these different disciplines and multiple health organizations are coming together to better understand how we can best tackle Alzheimer's disease. A main point of emphasis has been prevention, has been outreach, and I think, again, something like SF-247 could ideally help continue to support these efforts. And I want to emphasize, Twin Cities Consortium is kind of a misnomer because, in fact, we include members from throughout the state of Minnesota who participate and advance this mission, again, of trying to not only prevent Alzheimer's disease but support those families and persons with memory loss most effectively.
Thank you, Dr. Gogler. Senator Nelson, we have maybe 12 minutes, so
yes,
I want to reserve time for you to give the essence of the bill to us as well.
Yes.
and offer
I'd like
questions.
To make a couple comments, and then I'd like to turn it over to Marv, and then I will wrap up. So I think what you've heard today is the incidence of Alzheimer's is skyrocketing. It's the sixth leading cause of death, and as you know, it's tied to risk is of age. Age is one of the biggest risk factors. A couple things just for you to think about as we grapple with this as policymakers. The U.S. Population age 65 and above is expected to double by 2030, double. And, of course, that Minnesota is no different. One out of nine people who are age 65 have Alzheimer's. And by age 85, it's one out of three. Alzheimer's deaths have increased 68% from 2000 to 2010. So as you can see, the incidence is skyrocketing across our nation. And just to think about the magnitude of this problem, and you know it's tied to age, every day 10,000 baby boomers wake up and turn 65 in this country. And that's going to continue every day. Each and every day, another 10,000 hit that 65 mark for the next 19 years. That's the magnitude of the problem we face. And Minnesota is no exception. Since 2014 to 2020, we will see a 12% increase in Alzheimer's. and from 20 to 25, or by 2025, it will be a 21% increase in Alzheimer's. And over 5 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's, including, as you heard, an estimated 100,000 in Minnesota and their caregivers. And the other thing to keep in mind with this epidemic of Alzheimer's is the cost associated with it. I'd like you to look at the brochure in front of you. 20% of our Medicare and Medicaid dollars are spent on a person with Alzheimer's. $1 out of $5 is already being spent to take care of people with Alzheimer's in this country. $214 billion were spent on Alzheimer's in 2014. $150 million of that is Medicare and Medicaid. And you will notice the graph that shows how many research dollars we have compared to the cost. So it's staggering. Minnesota is not exempt. More Minnesota families, just like mine, are going to be touched with Alzheimer's. And it's going to be at a frightening rate, as we've discussed. And we've discussed that in addition to the human suffering, we're talking about the strain on the healthcare system and families, and of course then the enormous burden that it puts on family, state, and federal budgets. And with that, I would like to turn the testimony over to Dr. Marv Lofquist, who will share some comments with you about the disease.
Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Lofquist, to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Marvin Lofquist, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I grew up in a family with a history of heart disease. Both my parents died of heart disease by the age of 65, and both my older and younger brothers have had bypass surgeries. Prior to my diagnosis, I had limited awareness of the warning signs of Alzheimer's disease and never expected that I would one day be living with the disease. In 2010, after retiring from Northwestern University as an associate dean of the Weinberg College of Arts and Sciences, my wife, Elaine, and I moved from Chicago to Minneapolis to be closer to our children and grandchildren. After the move, I began to notice that I was not making much progress in learning the names of surrounding streets and new acquaintances. I soon found that I could not remember details about our appointments or social events, even if I saw them listed on our calendar. At a checkup with our family doctor, my wife and I shared our concerns regarding my increasing difficulty remembering details. The doctor recommended a variety of medical and psychological tests that led to the diagnosis of early stage Alzheimer's disease in May of 2012. The diagnosis would confirm my worst fear, but I knew I had to accept this as my new reality. After giving ourselves time to feel sad about this diagnosis, Elaine and I decided to share the information with our children and other close family members. To them and others, we focus on how Elaine and I have chosen to live our lives moving forward. We believe it is important to be open with others in order to reduce the stigma associated with this disease and to surround ourselves with support. After the diagnosis, my neuropsychologist recommended the HABIT program at the Mayo Clinic, which provides education about mild cognitive impairment for patients and their care partners. Through this program, we learned about the Alzheimer's Association and began attending an early stage support group program through the Minnesota North Dakota chapter. I quickly decided that if I was going to have Alzheimer's, I was going to get involved and see how I could help as an advocate. In a personal way, when I talk to other people about the disease, I am also talking to myself. As I am encouraging others to be strong in their determination to live well with the disease, I am also hearing this message and strengthening my own resolve. I can be tall. I can be short. I can have cancer. I can have heart disease. I can have Alzheimer's disease. But I am still Marvin Lofquist. I am still Elaine's husband. I still have a son, David, and a daughter, Laura. I am still Marv. I'm still me. Having a PhD in chemistry gives me the natural inclination to look for ways to support research to combat this disease. This motivation led to my enrollment in the Alzheimer's Association's trial match and the pursuit of participation in clinical trials. Research is the way we learn how things work. Research is how we can find what molecular changes are helpful and which are not. Disease is the result of unhelpful changes. We need to find ways to stop these unhelpful changes or reverse them. Sounds simple to me, but as you know, it is far more complex.
Senator Nelson, I think we need to move now to some questions, if it's possible.
Yes. Madam Chair, I think Marv might have had just a couple more comments, if he could please complete those.
Okay.
Thank you.
I currently serve on the Minnesota-North Dakota Advisory Council and the National Early Stage Advisory Group. Over the years, I had served on various boards, and when I retired, I planned on serving on other boards. My involvement in the Alzheimer's Association has restored my confidence that I can still contribute to society and make a difference through sharing my story. Addressing the scourge of Alzheimer's means supporting people living with the disease, the care partners, and those doing the research to find a way to end Alzheimer's. These endeavors have cost, but they have value beyond calculation. Your support is monumental in the effort to end Alzheimer's. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lovequist. Dr. Lovequist, I can just affirm what you're saying there, that your commitment to sharing your story is going to make a difference here. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, would you like me to do a walkthrough?
Yes, a quick walkthrough of the bill, and then if people will be ready with their questions, if you have them.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 247 sets up a grant program for Alzheimer's research. It's a $5 million grant program, focusing on those grants that have the greatest merit, competitive grant program, in finding causes, cures, treatment, and prevention. The money is appropriated in this bill, or it's determined by the Commissioner of Health, and the amendment that we're going to adopt is in consultation with the HESO director. And also, the other piece you need to know that this bill sets up is the Alzheimer's Research Advisory Council to help determine which of those grants are going to help us better tackle this skyrocketing disease. And that is a section of the bill as well where the Alzheimer's Research Advisory Council is set up. It's made up of 11 experts who can help determine what that is. And I will just read what those are to you so you understand that it's on page 1.29 in your bill. But the commissioner will appoint an 11-member advisory council consisting of two gerontologists, two geriatric psychiatrists, two geriatricians, two neuroscience, and three neurologists. So the point is, we have limited resources and we have a significant need. And my hope is that these competitive grants can be laser focused on those research proposals that have the greatest merit. The second aspect of the bill, besides the research grants, it also sets up dementia grants. It sets them up at a statewide level, statewide dementia grant program, and also then a regional and local dementia grant program. The purpose of that grant program, again, competitive grants, this time awarded through the Minnesota Board of Aging, is to select those grants that help promote Alzheimer's disease and other dementias awareness, promote the benefits of early cognitive testing in those populations at risk, and early diagnosis. And you heard a lot about the caregivers and connecting caregivers to the existing resources that we have. As I might have mentioned, my father is in the latter stages of dementia, and I have seen firsthand how incredibly important it is that we connect families and caregivers to those resources that are out there. And then finally, Madam Chair and members, this bill sets up the Alzheimer's Communication Program. This is a one-time appropriation through the Minnesota Board of Aging, which is, again, to start that statewide conversation that we need about Alzheimer's testing, prevention, cures, and caregivers. This part's not written into the bill, but as an example of how we can use existing resources, we've already have the senior linkage line, which is providing information to seniors, you know, looking at using some of our existing resources to help us tackle this Alzheimer's tsunami that we're facing. And so the things I'd like the committee to take away, I have more comments, but I know you've been very patient, is that, one, we know it's an epidemic. We know it's costly. It's coming at us, whether we're ready or not. But Minnesota can lead. We have the structures in place. We can build upon the good work that this legislature has already done with the 2009 Minnesota Alzheimer's Disease Working Group and preparing Minnesota to be a dementia-capable state. And so let's build upon that. We know research dollars are important to our state, and they bring a lot beyond the benefits of the research. They also add economic value to our state. So with that, I think there's probably committee members who have questions.
Yes, let's begin with their questions. I would say to the committee members, we have now gone to the time that we have at the committee hearing. With your permission, I think we can see the extent of questions that there are. If we can't get through them, we can lay this on the table since the testifiers have completed, and we can pick it up for action at another meeting. But for now, let's see where things are at. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this forward, Senator. I don't think there's a single person I know who hasn't been touched by a family or a friend or a loved one who has suffered Alzheimer's or dementia. And I think that this would be incredibly helpful progress towards being able to connect caregivers and support givers, family, and friends. And in an effort to be, and I do understand the importance of research dollars to help us move forward. In an effort to be helpful, I need to say clearly the chances of getting research dollars out of our very stretched Health and Human Services division are very, very, very slim. We don't fund research out of the Health and Human Services budget. We have a world-class research institution at the University of Minnesota, and their budget goes through higher ed. And so that's in the nature of attempting to be helpful. And it is not the first attempt to try to get Health and Human Services finance to fund research. And we've had tremendous pressure brought to bear to free, and were we to cross that threshold, we would be under tremendous pressure again and again and again with absolutely unmanageable requests to do primary research out of our Health and Human Services budgets that are intended for direct care. Some of the outreach and linking people, that is things that we do when we have a long and proud history of funding through HHS. I think that the oral amendment that you offered, and I was corrected, I guess it is a commissioner, I understand, but it's the Office of Higher Ed. But I don't think that making the Office of Higher Ed consulted with the grant would actually accomplish what we're trying to do. It would be more in the line of the appropriations. The first of the appropriations on page 6 would need to go someplace other than the Department of Health, which sits squarely in our budget, and I'm just very unlikely to get a target that allows me to help you. So I would go to the appropriation and try to direct it somewhere under the jurisdiction of the office of the department, the committee over higher ed, and you stand a better chance of success.
Senator
there.
Nelson, and then Senator Senator Hayden, then Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, I really appreciate those comments and know that they were very heartfelt and difficult at the same time. And I understand the realities in which we live here with our budget. My intention is to, should this committee so choose, to pass this and send it to finance where we can take up the your suggestion and do it in a very thoughtful manner. And I have visited with Senator Bonoff as well, and so I think she's somewhat, you never want to speak for another senator, but I think she might be expecting this legislation. So I take your comments very seriously and definitely understand them, and will work to make this bill a reality. And I will certainly be visiting with you and Senator Sharon and amending as necessary to do that. And hopefully we can do that in the Finance Committee.
Did you want to introduce your amendment? We have language for it now. I would have Mr. Monahan articulate the language that you recommended earlier.
Yes, please. Is that for the oral amendment?
Yes,
Madam
the oral
Chair?
Amendment. Yes.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members, amend the A1 amendment to Senate File 247 as follows. Page 1, line 4, after health, insert, comma, in consultation with the Commissioner of the Office of Higher Education, comma.
That is an oral amendment offered by Senator Nelson. Any further discussion? Senator Lurie?
Well, again, I don't think it quite gets to the
yes.
The sense that we need. It still would wind up squarely on the HHS budget going into finance. And the way finance works, you know, we're all divisions under
yes.
finance. There would still be nothing in the bill to direct it to the Division of Higher Education. This is kind of my point. If we changed where the funding goes, then it would have a dual track and it could have a better conversation once we got to finance.
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, that is my intention, actually, that it have that better discussion in finance and that dual track. And so if there is additional language that we need to put that in place now, I certainly am open to that. My understanding was once a bill is referred to finance, that any finance chair can say, I want to look at this bill. But if you believe, Senator Lurie, that we need additional language in this policy committee to address the finance before it goes to finance, certainly I would entertain that today. I don't have
we have an amendment that would do that. I don't know if we need to do that today. I just want to be certain that the committee understands that I would not either support a policy that changed or expanded the responsibilities of this budget to research through the Department of Health. That's the question. That's the policy question that we're saying would not make it through this committee unless there was a commitment, which there appears to be from Senator Nelson, to change the funding mechanism for the research components of this bill when we get to finance. And that's important to highlight that during the policy committee, because we want the general public to understand that this committee will not support, and hasn't in the past, efforts to expand the role and the funding mechanism of DHS for research. That's the issue.
I understand very clearly, and you have my commitment that we will thoughtfully work with you and Senator Lurie and Senator Bonoff to advance this bill in the way that it will succeed. And I understand the constraints on the health and Health and Human Services budgets, and so I believe there is a better way. My hope was in our limited time today to focus on the policy issues, but know that the policy issue regarding finance need some work.
Okay,
I understand
great.
That.
Let's make sure I get to Senator Hayden and then Senator Benson.
Madam Chair,
Senator
I
Benson,
to that
excuse
point,
me?
Perhaps Senator Nelson could just amend the A1 amendment on line 6.26, appropriated from the general fund to the Commissioner of the Office of Higher Ed. That way she has both financial bodies in the single bill. Either chair can pick it up in finance. And I would suggest perhaps, Senator Nelson, you find a way to break this into two pieces, find a different traveler for one piece, because, frankly, I think the request for the statewide grants might have an easier time getting through human services.
Senator Nelson, sorry, time is a matter here. And so because I'm hearing this from more committee members,
yes.
Senator Nelson, please would you agree to the A3 amendment being offered, which does exactly what you're talking about. If we distribute
yes,
the A3 amendment.
Out to me, that'd be fine.
Okay. The A3 amendment is being distributed now. In essence, does what Senator Benson said, which is deletes references of the Department of Human Services and refers to the Office of Higher Education. Thank you. Any further discussion on the amendment, the A3 amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, I have one question. Is it still, even with the word delete, I assume it's still dual-tracked?
Yes.
Even though we know it needs to go to higher ed.
These changes only relate to the elements of the bill that are this research, not all elements of the bill. I want to confirm that. It's just section one, yes.
Thank you. I will accept this as a friendly amendment.
Thank you. Madam Chair. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Thank you very much, Senator Nelson. Senator Hayden.
Yeah, briefly, Madam Chair, well, Senator Nelson, thank you for bringing the bill. I think I was kind of going down the lines of Senator Lori. I had a similar bill last year that Senator Hoffman has this year on spinal cord research and TBI issues, and it was same issue about where should this go with the limited resources. So I'm glad that we are kind of bifurcating the bill and seeing if we can get it financed through the Office of Higher Ed and our great research institutions. The only other thing that I would kind of more of a statement is last year we did some good work working in communities of color, making sure that they are somehow involved in this conversation, and I'm sure they are. So this year I just want us to continue, and I don't have a suggestion today, but somewhere that we might talk and figure out how to make sure that on the task force in the outreach that we are targeting those communities which not only have the issue as everyone else but disproportionately often don't have the access and resources to be identified early and get some of the great care and develop the research that we know is happening. So that's more of a comment, Madam Chair, and Senator Nelson, I'll talk to you kind of offline about that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Nelson,
yes.
I need you to take your motion regarding your oral amendment off the table. Would you be willing to remove your oral amendment, which spoke—
In consultation
yeah.
with?
Yes.
After we found out we do have a commissioner? Yes, I can do
thank
that.
You. Thank you. So Senator Nelson withdraws her oral amendment. And excuse me, I have to check the name here. Okay. The motion eventually be— To refer to state and local government? I guess state and local government is the first to receive the bill, but I see that one of your testifiers would like to make a comment at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't mean to hold up the meeting at all. In regards to Senator Hayden's point and Senator—
This is, you have to, we have to say your name. Senator, it's—
I have to say my
Joseph
name?
Joseph Gogler.
Yeah, Dr. Gogler, yeah. So, Senator Hayden, with regards to your point, it's an excellent point. Act on Alzheimer's, which is a statewide kind of really grassroots movement to develop dementia-capable communities. An African-American Act on Alzheimer's has begun, and it just met for the first time, I think, 2 or 3 months ago. I'd highly recommend, if that's definitely going to be something you want to broaden perspectives on, that's probably the group, a great group to engage with.
Good. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions on the bill? Then, Senator Nelson, I think your motion would be to pass Senate File 247 as amended and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make that motion and thank committee members for their time and ask that they look at the letters of support in their packets as time permits. But thank you very much, Madam Chair. That is my motion.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much, and we are adjourned.